In August 1887, the largest mass murder in Georgia history left Bibb County residents in shock. 9 members of one family were attacked and murdered in their home, and the sole survivor of that attack, Thomas Woolfork, was convicted and executed for the murders. But a decade later, a shocking confession would stir up a debate that's been lingering for well over 130 years. This is the mystery of the Woolfork murders. This is Southern Mysteries.
It's gonna be all right. These ain't dark or troubled times. It's a day like any other day. You got a dark and troubled mind, all right. You hold that baby tight, and I swear if you can hear me, then everything gonna be just fine, all right. All right.
Welcome to Southern Mysteries, exploring historical mysteries and legendary figures of the American South. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. Rose Hill Cemetery opened in Macon, Georgia in 1840. The scenic cemetery, situated along the Ocmulgee River, was designed as a park where residents enjoyed picnics and long walks with family and friends. And of course, served as the final resting place for many citizens of Macon and Bibb County. Rose Hill's beauty has not faded. It's still a popular place to visit for locals and tourists alike. Within the grounds of Rose Hill, there are countless stories of men and women who died tragically, many who were gone too soon or taken from those who loved them in the most unnatural of ways. Including 9 members of one family. They're buried in the Forest Hill section of Rose Hill. Their graves and markers, simple. You'd never know by looking at the family plot that more than 2,000 people lined up along the grounds of the cemetery on a hot August morning in 1887 to pay their final respects to the Woolfork family. They had been brutally murdered in their home on August 6. The nature of the murders had shocked Macon, and news of the largest mass murder in Georgia history spread quickly across the country. The graveside memorial was offered by Reverend I.R. Branham, who stood near the 9 coffins and paused for a moment, waiting for the large crowd to quiet before he prayed for the victims. 54-year-old Captain Richard Woolfork, his wife, 41-year-old Maddie's 84-year-old aunt, Temperance West, and Richard and Maddie's 6 children, 20-year-old Richard Jr., 17-year-old Pearl, 10-year-old Annie, 7-year-old Rosebud, 5-year-old Charlie, and 18-month-old baby Maddie. Reverend Branham spoke of the uncertainty of life, how he felt ill-equipped to make sense of what had happened to the Woolforks, tried to offer some sense of comfort to the community that had been shattered by this loss. The Reverend then offered up a prayer for the one member of the family who was in prison, praying, "Whatever may be his destiny, O Lord, prepare him for it." The prisoner was 27-year-old Tom Woolfork, the son of the slain Captain Richard Woolfork and the captain's first wife, Susan. Captain Richard Woolfork was from a well-loved family in Macon. The Woolforks had migrated to Georgia from North Carolina in the early 19th century. They bought 100 acres of land along the Ocmulgee River in 1828 and built a family home and cotton plantation 13 miles west of Macon. The single-story Woolfork home was part of Richard Woolfork's inheritance when his father passed away. The 5-room home featured a 6-columned porch, high ceilings with crown molding, and a pristine whitewashed exterior surrounded by gardens and a perfectly whitewashed picket fence. The home was constructed on a hill surrounded by Woolfork farmland and tenant homes where the plantation's sharecroppers lived. Here in this home, on June 18, 1860, Tom Woolfork was born. His parents, Richard and Susan, had met in Athens, Georgia, when Richard was attending the University of Georgia. They married in 1852, and within 3 years would welcome their three children, two daughters, Floride, who everyone called Flo, and Lily, followed by their son, Tom. Tragically, Susan died when Tom was just 5 years old. Richard Wilfork was devastated by the loss of his wife. He sent their three children to live with Susan's sister in Athens. Tom's aunt, Fanny Moore Crane, would become the mother figure to Tom and his sisters. She kept Susan's memory alive by telling the children stories about her. Tom's connection with his aunt and admiration for her would continue throughout his life. During the years Tom lived in Athens, the Civil War had come to an end, and his father, Richard Wilfork, was trying to navigate a changing South. He had served as a Confederate captain of a militia unit during the war, which is why everyone just called him Captain. He worked hard to begin a new life after the war, eventually operating a hardware business known as Wilfork & Company. His investors were kind and supportive, believed in him and his desire to succeed. All signs pointed to a bright future for the captain's business, which was true for a time. In fact, the captain bought out his investors' shares in the business, but within months of that move, prices fell and the captain was forced to borrow a lot of money. His collateral for loans would be his family's property. That decision caused financial strain for Captain Wilfork until the day he died. In 1867, the captain married again. Maddie Howard, who was from a wealthy family in Macon, made for a smart match on a financial level. The Howard family went above and beyond to help the captain save portions of his family's property he had lost to the bank when he was unable to repay loans. But the match was about more than finances. The captain and Maddie were devoted to one another. Soon after they married, Maddie suggested it was time for the captain to be reunited with his children. At her suggestion, Tom and his sisters returned to the Wilfork home in Macon. Over the course of their marriage, Richard and Maddie would have six children. The first child, Richard Jr., born within a year of their marriage. Later, they would welcome Pearl, Annie, Rosebud, and Charlie. Their sixth and final child, Maddie, was born in 1886. Things in the Wilfork home were challenging for Tom Wilfork, who was not fond of his stepmother, and as each half-brother and half-sister was born, he felt threatened and openly shared with anyone who would listen that he disliked them all. There was clearly tension, but there's never been mention of Maddie Wilfork being a wicked stepmother. By all accounts, she loved the captain, their children, and did all she could to welcome her stepchildren and create a united family when Tom and his sisters returned to Macon. But Tom could never accept Maddie as a member of the family. He would tell friends and his beloved aunt that he felt left out in the home. Tom felt, with the birth of each half-sibling, he was being pushed further and further away from what mattered most to him, money and the inheritance of the family home and plantation that he believed he and his two sisters were entitled to, not Maddie and his half-siblings. There's no evidence that Tom's sisters, Flo or Lily, felt the same way. In fact, newspaper accounts of the Wilfork family funeral in August of 1887 note that the sisters displayed such sorrow when they looked upon the caskets that those attending the service were moved to tears by the sisters' obvious grief. It seems the sisters felt the loss of the nine Wilforks deeply, perhaps because they knew they had most likely lost a brother that day as well. A brother who was known as an unstable man, who had openly spoken of his hate for all of the family members who were buried in Rose Hill. Tom Wilfork's troubled life was evident to all around him. He often traveled from Macon to Athens to visit his Aunt Fanny, who noticed a change in him. With each visit, he seemed to grow more paranoid and seemed at times to be what she called a wild creature. She confided to friends that Tom would pace the floor of her home at all hours of the night and would occasionally speak incoherently. Tom Wolfork left his father's home to try to prove his worth to his father, prove that he was worthy of the inheritance he felt he was owed. But proving himself was difficult because Tom loved liquor and drank too much of it, was never able to hold down a job for long. This led Tom to make desperate moves. He would get caught up in questionable money-making schemes, which failed and left him in debt. His father would bail him out time and time again. But eventually, the captain told Tom he couldn't help him anymore. His father had his own financial issues, but Tom didn't believe that to be true. All Tom heard when his father said no was his stepmother coming between them and forcing his father to push away his son. Tom tried to establish himself as an independent man in Macon, leasing a plantation of his own, but that failed within 2 years. He tried opening a grocery store, but it too failed. He thought moving to Texas and becoming a cowboy would be a great idea, but that venture only lasted a few months. Once again, Tom returned to Macon a failure. He tried to earn a living as a streetcar driver, but that job only lasted a few days. Liquor and Tom's hot temper and paranoia made him a risk most employers just weren't willing to take on. Tom Wolfork figured that if work couldn't prove his worth to his father, marriage would do the trick. He was sure that by starting his own family, he could convince his father to give him money. Tom married Georgia Bird in 1887. She was from a wealthy farming family near Jones County, Georgia, who felt Tom was the wrong man for her. Her father expressed concerns over Tom's strange behavior and questionable family situation. But Georgia was willing to rush head on into marriage to Tom because he told her he could provide for her thanks to his fine home in Macon and all the money he would inherit from his father. Tom and Georgia boarded a train, found a minister, and were married en route to Macon. But as the train pulled into the station and the newlywed couple disembarked, Tom took Georgia to his sister's house. That's when she realized Tom had lied to her about the big house and all the money. Tom swore to Georgia that if he didn't get his money, none of the other family members were going to get it. Georgia realized she had made a big mistake, was scared of Tom and his erratic behavior. Within 3 weeks of their marriage, she boarded a train and headed back to her father's house. In June 1887, Tom made his final trip to visit his Aunt Fanny in Athens. When Tom left her home, Aunt Fanny confided to friends that her beloved nephew seemed to be losing his mind. He had been unusually paranoid, speaking incoherently as he paced the floors of her home. When Tom left Athens, he returned to Captain Wolfork's home because he had nowhere else to go. The condition of his return was that Tom would work on the plantation and earn his keep, earning $9 a month. From that moment on, tension appeared to be on the rise between Tom and his family. Tom would often be at odds with his eldest half-brother and sister, Richard and Pearl. Mattie Wolfork's father, Benjamin Howard, also knew of the tension because his daughter visited him a few days before she was murdered. She sought his advice as to how to move forward with Tom in the home. She mentioned her stepson had threatened some of his siblings and had threatened to kill her and send her straight to hell. Around 10 a.m. on August 6, 1887, a messenger rode into Macon to deliver a note to the clerk of the Superior Court. The note requested a coroner ride immediately to the Wolf Fork home to begin an investigation into the murder of 9 members of the family. The message noted the sole survivor of the attack, 27-year-old Tom Wolf Fork, was being held in a room in the home due to the belief he could be involved in the murders. Early in the morning, Tom had run to the home of a plantation sharecropper, a black man named Green Lockett. Tom claimed he had struggled with intruders and barely made it out of the home alive. He said he was certain all of his family had been killed, but he had escaped by jumping through a window. Tom asked Green Lockett to go back to the house with him, but Green was aware of Tom's at times erratic behavior and aware of the precarious situation he would find himself in if he returned to that home and found Tom's story to be true. This was a black sharecropper in the years following the Civil War. He needed to proceed with caution lest he be accused of killing a white man and his family. He knew he could be lynched. Perhaps that was part of Tom's plan. But if so, it didn't work. Green Lockett ran to get more sharecroppers to help before heading back to the Wolf Fork house. Tom returned to the home ahead of Green or anyone else. When authorities arrived, he said he had been inside to confirm that his family was dead. He mentioned that when he went in, he heard the killer or killers leave by way of the back gate. He also shared that he had moved a couple of the bodies onto the bed when he was checking to see if they were dead. Now, this disturbed those who walked into the Wolf Fork house on that August day in 1887 and saw what Tom had seen. One of the most horrific crime scenes in Georgia history. But it was the scene of his family's murder, and he seemed so nonchalant in letting people know his family was dead, led to immediate suspicion that Tom was the only member of the family that had survived because he was the person who had murdered them. When the coroner arrived at the Wolf Fork home, he walked into the hallway and saw a parlor to the right of the entranceway and a bedroom in the rear of it. In that bedroom, he found the first of 9 victims who had been murdered in a manner that shocked those who witnessed the scene. The remaining victims were found in another bedroom. One reporter who viewed the crime scene that day wrote that as he walked into the Wolf Fork home, his heart grew sick. He could hardly comprehend what he was seeing, as if he was looking upon a nightmare. Sometime between 2 and 4 a.m., Captain Richard Wolf Fork, his wife Maddie, her great-aunt Temperance, along with the Wolf Fork's 6 children, had been bludgeoned to death with an axe. 6 of the victims were found dead in bed. The 2 sons who were murdered were found on the floor of their parents' bedroom. And 10-year-old Annie was found kneeling in front of an open window, as she appeared to have made an attempt to escape through it. Every newspaper account of the Wolf Fork family murders made it clear that the scene was horrific, with, and I'm quoting the Macon Telegraph here, blood, bone, and brain on the floor of the rooms where the victims were discovered, with blood smattered over the walls and pooled on the floor. The murder weapon, a short-handled axe, was found inside the home. It was covered with blood and hair. A witness came forward and informed the coroner that he had seen Tom Wolf Fork chopping wood with that very axe the day before the murders. This would be one of many signs that pointed to Tom's involvement in the murders. Along with a murder weapon allegedly belonging to him and his strange behavior at the scene, there was no sign of forced entry. If there was no forced entry and nothing had been stolen, Tom's story of strangers breaking in just didn't add up. When Tom was questioned again about what had happened in the home, Authorities noticed that Tom had specks of blood in his ears and a bloody handprint on his leg. He explained away that blood by reminding the coroner he had moved a couple of the bodies when he had checked to see if they were dead. Tom also said he had tried to clean some of the blood from the floor before the coroner arrived. He explained bloody footprints in one of the bedrooms probably came from him when he moved bodies or tried to clean up a little. As Tom spoke of his family, moving their dead bodies, cleaning the pools of blood on the floor of the family home, he showed no emotion, and as the coroner noted, no agitation, which you would expect from someone who had experienced trauma, such as seeing members of your family murdered or fighting off intruders and running for your life. Tom just didn't seem upset about the murders. In fact, the growing crowd on and around the Wolf Fork property seemed more concerned about it than Tom. Between 2,000 and 3,000 people gathered as the coroner's inquiry continued. As more and more details of the murders were revealed, and it became evident that Tom Wolf Fork was the only suspect and was being held in the home, the crowd grew angry. There were fears the crowd wanted to skip a trial and lynch Tom that very afternoon. The Wolf Forks were prominent and well-loved in Macon and Bibb County, and the community was outraged that they had been murdered. They wanted someone to pay. As tensions grew, the sheriff quietly removed Tom from the home and took him to jail to keep him safe until the coroner handed down his verdict. The coroner took into account Tom's behavior, all the evidence that had been found at the scene, including bloody clothing discovered in a well and assumed to be Tom's. The coroner ruled he believed Tom was responsible for the murders and would stand trial. The crowd that had gathered screamed and vowed that they would lynch Tom that very night, demanded he be handed over. The local sheriff sought help and was able to get Tom out of Macon and into a jail in Atlanta, where he would remain until his trial. Papers across the nation ran daily headlines for weeks, keeping folks updated on developments with the gruesome Georgia murders and the accused killer, now known as Bloody Wolf Fork. Tom's Aunt Fanny and his sisters, Flo and Lily, visited him in jail and publicly vowed that Tom was an innocent man. They never wavered in their support of him. Early in his jail stay, all kinds of people visited the jail to, quite literally, gawk at Tom, who was now known as the monster who killed his family, including an 18-month-old baby. After a while, Tom asked that no visitors be allowed, but some reporters did sneak in to try to get an interview with Bloody Wolf Fork. A reporter from the Savannah Morning News boasted of posing as a lawyer and convincing Tom to trust him. He got Tom to talk about what his future would hold if he were to be found not guilty. Tom made it clear that he felt he would be fine and would return home to the Wolf Fork house and his substantial inheritance of an estimated $40,000. The reporter pressed Tom on that matter, saying he was unsure if Tom could legally inherit the house and unsure if his father had that much money, considering all of his financial troubles. Tom's temper flared, and he ordered the man to leave. It turns out the reporter had a point. Captain Wolf Fork had financial trouble when he married Maddie Howard. His father had purchased Wolf Fork family property, including the plantation home, and deeded it back to his daughter Maddie. All those years, Tom had been ranting about his inheritance and getting it back for himself and his sisters. Well, he was operating without all the facts. With the death of Maddie Wolf Fork and the children she and the captain shared, the Wolf Fork property and the home would most likely legally be the inheritance of Maddie's father, Benjamin Howard. Tom Woolfork was indicted on 9 counts of murder, but when he stood trial in Bibb County, Georgia, on December 5th, 1887, he was only tried for the murder of his father. The state's attorney, John Hardiman, wanted Tom to stand trial for only one of the murders because he knew if Tom managed to be acquitted, state law allowed him to try Tom for each of the victims, meaning he would prosecute him 8 more times until he got the conviction he felt should be handed down. Tom's defense attorney was known as Macon's best, the well-respected John Rutherford, who fought hard for his client. The circumstantial evidence was strong. Authorities had never considered another suspect. When the jury deliberated on December 15th, they returned a verdict of guilty in just under 12 minutes. Bloody Woolfork learned his sentence that day. He was to hang for the murders. John Rutherford appealed the conviction, arguing his client should have a new trial because of mistakes made by Judge George Gustin that robbed his client of a fair trial. Despite Rutherford's objections, the court did nothing to stop courtroom spectators from yelling during opening and closing arguments that Bloody Woolfork should hang. The judge also allowed hearsay testimony and some evidence that should not have been admissible. The Supreme Court of Georgia ruled in favor of the defendant and granted him a new trial with a change of venue. Tom Woolfork's second jury trial began in Perry, Georgia, in the Supreme Court of Houston County on June 3, 1889. Tom's demeanor in court during the second trial was the same as the first, stoic. He barely reacted to anything happening in the courtroom and was even seen reading books during court proceedings. It seems Tom held on to the belief that John Rutherford would save his life. He never believed he would hang, which is why Tom remained calm on June 24th when the jury came back after deliberating for 45 minutes. Tom Woolfork was once again found guilty and sentenced to hang for murder. He immediately turned to his attorney and said he wasn't afraid. Rutherford did all he could to save his client's life. He appealed the decision, but the state Supreme Court upheld the conviction. As Tom awaited the gallows, a man named Jackson DuBose was arrested and charged as an accomplice in the murders. He confessed in a rather boastful manner that he had taken part in them, but it seems he had a habit of confessing to crimes he didn't commit. After meeting with a judge for over an hour, the judge ordered that all murder charges against DuBose be dropped. The judge found him guilty of lunacy and sentenced him to time in an insane asylum. Knowing his execution date was near, Tom Woolfork tried his hand at bribery. On the night before he was to hang in Perry, Georgia, Tom attempted to bribe his death watchman into allowing him to escape, offered the watchman $500 to just leave his cell unlocked and turn away. But the watchman could not be bribed. On October 29, 1890, Tom was served his final meal, a breakfast of ham and eggs, waffles, grits, hot buttermilk biscuits with syrup, and a pot of coffee. He was allowed to savor a final shot of whiskey before he met with 3 ministers to go over his final wishes, which included that he wished to be buried in Hawkinsville, where his sister Flo and her family lived. Tom's execution took place at gallows that were built in a little valley near Big Indian Creek, a little less than a mile from the Houston County Courthouse. The site was chosen because it allowed spectators a clear view of execution. Around 1:15 that October afternoon, more than 10,000 people gathered in Perry and watched as Bloody Woolfork, dressed in black, was guided to the gallows by the sheriff and ministers. They wanted to hear Tom say it before he died, say that he had killed his family They expected him to beg for mercy as he stood on the gallows with a rope around his neck. Tom Woolfolk was as stoic on the day of his execution as he had been during his trials and on the day his family was murdered. He had prepared a statement that a minister read to the crowd. Tom's statement read as follows. I, Tom Woolfolk, recognizing that the infinitely wise and holy God sees my heart and knows all that I have ever done, and fully understanding that I must stand before his judgment bar, and that today, in a few hours, I shall be called into his presence, do, in view of the solemnity of the occasion, declare my innocence and leave as my last declaration that I did not take the life of my father or any member of his family, or have I any knowledge of the person or persons who did this murderous deed. Once Tom's statement was read, thousands watched as Tom Woolfolk stepped forward, lifted his head towards the heavens, and prayed that God bless his sisters and the people who had done so much to try to save his life. Bloody Woolfolk's final words were his prayer that God have mercy on his soul. A noose was then placed around Tom Woolfolk's neck, and at precisely 1:30 p.m., the trap was sprung. The crowd quickly realized something had gone wrong. The noose had not been placed around Tom's neck as securely as it should have been. When the trap sprung open, Tom's neck did not break. The crowd waited and watched for 11 minutes as Tom Woolfolk slowly strangled to death. Tom was then cut down from the gallows and his body was taken to an undertaker in Hawkinsville, Georgia, where he was laid to rest that day in Orange Hills Cemetery. Hearing Tom's story makes you believe this man was the male equivalent of Lizzie Borden. His name's even been invoked in a children's song, just like Lizzie's. The song lyrics go, "Woolfolk, Woolfolk, look what you've done. You killed your family and didn't fire a gun." But did he? If you ask some Woolfolk family ancestors, they maintain that Tom was not a killer. Unstable, perhaps mentally ill, but not the man who murdered 9 members of their family. But if it wasn't Tom, who was it? Some believe it was a man named Simon Cooper. The Woolfolk family name was associated with wealth and respect among white families in the area, but Captain Woolfolk was not beloved among the black community or the sharecroppers who worked his land, which included Simon Cooper. Remember, the captain had fought in the Confederacy in the Civil War. If the Confederates had won, Simon and his fellow workers on that plantation would be enslaved, and some felt they were treated as though they still were. We know that Simon Cooper and the captain were at odds many a time. In fact, within days of the murder of Captain Woolfolk and his family and the arrest of Tom, Simon Cooper left town and was never seen in the area again. Maybe he left town because he assumed he would be a suspect in the murders. Or maybe he left town because he was guilty of something. Simon Cooper was relatively forgotten around Bibb County until a decade later, on January 7, 1897, when his name appeared in newspaper articles detailing a South Carolina manhunt. Simon Cooper had been the subject of a manhunt following the murder of a black man on New Year's Day. The manhunt had grown larger after witnesses ID'd him as the man who used an axe to murder 5 members of the Wilson family near Sumter, South Carolina, along with the murder of another black man. Days after the New Year's murder, Cooper attempted to force a young black girl to marry him. The girl's mother took her daughter and ran into a nearby swamp where they were able to hide out until Cooper moved on. An enraged Simon Cooper ended up at the home of a black man named Boyle. He stole Boyle's horse and forced Boyle's son to join him on the run. Cooper and this young man rode about a mile until Simon Cooper stopped outside of the home of a local white farmer, Ben Wilson. Soon after, neighbors heard all kinds of commotion in the Wilson home, including blood-curdling screams. Some ran towards the Wilsons to help. That's when Simon Cooper emerged from the home, shooting in all directions. He ran to a buggy on the property, and as he tried to flee, one of the Wilsons' farmhands, a black man named Smith, tried to stop Cooper. Smith's body was later found with an axe in the back of his almost severed head. When authorities went into the Wilsons' home, they found 75-year-old Ben Wilson sitting up in the bed with a shotgun in his hand, having tried but failed in his attempt to defend his family. Ben, his son Wesley, and three other family members had been bludgeoned to death with an axe. White and black members of the community joined together in the search for Simon Cooper. Around 10 a.m. on January the 8th, Jake Dargan, a black sharecropper, went to the house of his white neighbor, W.S. Burnett. He let him know that Simon Cooper had forced his way into his cabin and was sleeping there. Burnett rode out to get the sheriff and posse, who surrounded the house and ordered Cooper to come out. He refused, and it became clear that Cooper had found guns and ammo while he was on the run because he was firing at the posse. He was well armed and refused to go down without a fight. The cabin was small and situated on a hill, which gave Cooper the advantage in the gunfight. The moment the sheriff's men tried to make a move, they were fired upon. Hours into the fight, the sheriff telegraphed the governor and requested a special train be loaded with long-range rifles, ammunition, and a cannon and sent to him immediately. Now, the sheriff did get some heavy artillery to help with the gunfight, but hours later, Simon Cooper finally answered back when the sheriff asked if he was willing to talk. Cooper said he was, even walked out into the yard, but when someone in the posse saw Cooper reach for a gun, they fired at him. Cooper yelled that he would never be taken alive and ran back into the cabin. By noon that day, the sheriff ordered that the posse close in on Cooper and take him into custody. When he attempted to open the door of the cabin, Simon Cooper was grabbed by two men and pulled outside. The sheriff wanted Cooper taken in alive so he could face trial, but that wouldn't happen. On the ride towards the Sumter Jail, a mob of about 100 men met the posse and demanded they turn over Cooper. When the sheriff and his men refused, the officers were beaten and overpowered by that mob. Within minutes, Simon Cooper had a noose around his neck and was hanging from a tree by the side of the road as the mob fired an estimated 150 bullets into his body. The sheriff always maintained that lynching Simon Cooper robbed the Wilson family of a trial, of the chance to face the man who murdered their family. And it robbed us of a potential answer to the mystery of who killed the Woolfolk family. Simon Cooper was a criminal, a cold-blooded killer. He and Tom Woolfolk seemed to have a lot in common. They both had strained relationships with their family. In fact, Simon's family refused to claim his body and wanted no part in his burial after his rampage. Some believe they were both cold-blooded killers who had possibly worked together to murder the Woolforks before Simon Cooper fled Georgia. Or perhaps Simon Cooper was the man who carried out the deadliest mass murder in Georgia history and went on to carry out a second murder spree a decade later. You may find the idea that Tom Woolfolk could be innocent to be unbelievable. But a lot of people believe that's the truth because Simon Cooper said it was true. On November 11th, 1898, the headline of the Macon Republic read, "An innocent man was hanged." The reporter noted that word had reached the city that a year earlier, a journal was found among the belongings of Simon Cooper following his death. One journal entry caught the attention of authorities and left Macon and the country in shock when it made the papers. The entry from Simon Cooper's journal read as follows. "Tom Woolfork was mighty slick, but I fixed him. I would have killed him with the rest of the damn family, but he was not at home." This revelation has caused debate for generations. Did Simon Cooper really kill the Woolfork family and enjoy watching Tom take the fall for his crime? Or did Tom Woolfork kill his family and Simon Cooper tried to take credit for the kills? Well, the answer to that mystery, it went to the grave with Simon Cooper, Tom Woolfork, and the nine victims violently murdered in the Woolfork home in August of 1887. The day the Woolforks were buried, thousands gathered in and around Rose Hill Cemetery. Despite heavy rain that fell at times, people continued to visit and pay their respects as workers carefully and respectfully filled and covered two rows of graves. No matter how heavy the rain, people kept coming to see the Woolforks' graves as if they had to see it to believe what had happened. The graves were originally unmarked, covered with simple red brick overlays. In 2005, headstones were finally placed on each grave, noting the birth date of each victim and the date of death that united them for an eternity and began the never-ending mystery of who killed the Woolfork family. Southern Mysteries is hosted and produced by me, Shannon Ballard. If you want to dive deeper into the mystery and the theories of the Woolfork murders, Carolyn DeLoach has written detailed, in-depth books about the murders. Her books include her theory that Simon Cooper murdered the Woolforks in 1887 with the help of fellow sharecroppers who had tired of tensions with Captain Woolfork. If you want to read more about her theory and more around one of the most enduring of Southern mysteries, read Shadow Chasers, The Woolfork Tragedy Revisited. You'll find a link in the show notes for this episode at southernmysteries.com. And a special thanks to Jessica D., who made me aware of the Woolfork murders mystery. If you're enjoying Southern Mysteries, I invite you to support the show on Patreon. Your support ensures this independent podcast continues. There are a few membership options, including one that gives you access to monthly bonus content called Southern Mysteries Shorts. Thanks to new members Deborah S. from Hindston, Louisiana, and Elizabeth C. from Mount Eliza, Australia, for your support. If you'd like to learn more about supporting the show like Deborah and Elizabeth, visit patreon.com/southernmysteries or find the link to Patreon in the show notes where you're listening. And remember to subscribe to the show where you're listening now so you'll always have new episodes of Southern Mysteries in your player. Thanks for listening.